Go, I say. Forget our bargains. Forget everything. Get out of here.
Why are you doing this?
She asks me.
For Cardin, I say. I leave unsaid the second part.
Because his mother is still alive, and mine is not.
Because even if he hates you, at least he should get a chance to tell you about it.
With one baffled look back at me, she begins to ascend. I need to know if Baelkin is still imprisoned, if he's still alive. I head lower, picking my way through the gloom with one hand against the wall and the other holding my blade. The ghost calls my name, probably because of Asha's abrupt arrival in front of him, but I am intent on my purpose. My feet grow swifter and more sure on the spiral steps. I find Baelkin's cell is empty, the bars bent and broken, his opulent rugs wet and covered in sand. Orla took Baelkin, stole a prince of fairy from right under my nose. I curse my own short-sightedness. I knew they were meeting, knew they were scheming together. But I was sure, because of Nikasia, that Orla truly wanted Cardin to be the bridegroom of the sea. It didn't occur to me that Orla would act before hearing an answer, and I didn't think that when she threatened to take blood, she meant Baelkin. Baelkin! It would be difficult to get the crown of fairy on his head without Oak putting it there. But should Cardin ever abdicate, that would mean a period of instability. Another coronation. Another chance for Baelkin to rule. I think of Oak, who is not ready for any of this. I think of Cardin, who must be persuaded to pledge himself to me again, especially now. I am still swearing when I hear a wave strike the rocks, hard enough to reverberate through the tower. The ghost shouts my name again, from closer by than I expect. I turn as he steps into view on the other side of the room. Beside him are three of the sea folk, watching me with pale eyes. It takes me a moment to put the image together, to realize the ghost is not restrained, nor even menaced.
To realize this is a betrayal.
My face goes hot. I want to feel angry, but instead I feel a roaring in my head that overwhelms everything else. The sea crashes against the shore again, slamming into the side of the tower. I am glad Nightfell is already in my hand. Why? I ask, hearing Nikasia's words pounding in my ears like the surf. Someone you trust has already betrayed you.
I served Prince Dane, the ghost says. Not you.
I begin to speak when there is a rustle behind me, then pain in the back of my skull, and nothing more.
Book 2. They stole little Bridget for 7 years long. When she came down again, her friends were all gone. They took her lightly back, between the night and morrow. They thought that she was fast asleep, but she was dead with sorrow. They have kept her ever since, deep within the lake, on a bed of flag leaves, watching till she wake. William Allingham, The Fairies. Chapter 22. I wake at the bottom of the sea. At first, I panic. I have water in my lungs, and a terrible pressure on my chest. I open my mouth to scream, and a sound comes out, but not the one I expect. It startles me enough to stop and realize that I am not drowning. I am alive. I am breathing water, heavily, laboriously, but I am breathing it. Beneath me is a bed, shaped from reef coral, and padded with kelp, long tendrils of which flutter with the current. I am inside a building, which seems also of coral. Fish dart through the windows. Nikasia floats at the end of my bed, her feet replaced by a long tail. It feels like seeing her for the first time, to see her in the water, to see her blue-green hair whirl around her, and her pale eyes shine metallic under the waves. She was beautiful on land, but here she looks elemental, terrifying in her beauty.
"This is for Cardin," she says, just before she balls up her fist and hits me in the stomach. I wouldn't have thought it possible to get the momentum needed to strike someone underwater, but this is her world, and she connects just fine.
"Ouch," I say. I try to touch where she hit me, but my wrists are restrained in heavy cuffs and won't move that far. I turn my head, seeing boulders anchoring me to the floor. A fresh panic grips me, bringing with it a sense of unreality.
"I don't know what trick you performed on him, but I will discover it," she says, unnerving me with how close her guess comes to the mark.
Still, it means she doesn't know anything. I force myself to concentrate on that, on the here and now, on discovering what I can do and making a plan. But it's hard when I am so very angry. Angry at the ghost for betraying me. Angry at Nikasia. And at myself. Myself. Always myself. More than anyone else. Furious at myself for winding up in this position.
"What happened to the ghost?" I spit out. "Where is he?"
Nikasia gives me a narrow-eyed look.
"What?"
"He helped you kidnap me." "Did you pay him?" I ask, trying to sound calm. What I most want to know is what I cannot ask. Does she know the ghost's plans for the Court of Shadows? But to find out and stop him, I must escape. Nikasia puts her hand against my cheek, smooths back my hair.
"Worry about yourself."
Maybe she only wants me here for reasons of personal jealousy. Maybe I can still get out of this. "You think I performed a trick because Cardin likes me better than you," I say. "But you shot at him with a crossbow bolt. Of course he likes me better." Her face goes pale, her mouth opening in surprise, and then curling into rage when she realizes what I am implying, that I told him. Maybe it's not a great idea to goad her into fury when I am powerless. But I hope she will be goaded into telling me why I am here. And how long I must stay. Already, time has passed while I was unconscious. Time when Matic is free to scheme toward war with his new knowledge of my influence over the crown. When Cardin is entirely free to do whatever his chaotic heart desires. When Locke may make a mockery of everyone he can, and draw them into his dramatics. When the council may push for capitulation to the sea, and I can do nothing to stop any of it. How much more time will I spend here? How long before all 5 months of work is undone? I think of Valmorin, tossing things in the air, and letting them crash down around him. His human face, and his unsympathetic human eyes. Nikasia seems to have regained her composure, but her long tail swishes back and forth.
"Well, you're ours now, mortal. Cardin will regret the day he put any trust in you."
She means me to be more afraid, but I feel a little relief. They don't think I have any special power. They think I have a special vulnerability. They think they can control me, as they would any mortal. Still, relief is the last thing I ought to show.
"Yeah, Cardin should definitely trust you more. You seem really trustworthy. It's not like you're actually currently betraying him."
Nikasia reaches into a bandolier across her chest and draws a blade. A shark's tooth. Holding it, she gazes at me.
"I could hurt you, and you wouldn't remember."
"But you would," I say. She smiles.
"Perhaps that would be something to cherish."
My heart thunders in my chest,
but I refuse to show it. Want me to show you where to put the point? I ask. It's delicate work. Causing pain, without doing permanent damage.
Are you too stupid to be afraid?
Oh, I'm scared, I tell her. Just not of you. Whoever brought me here? Your mother, I presume. And Bilkin. Has a use for me. I'm afraid of what that is. But not of you. An inept torturer who is irrelevant to everyone's plans. Nikasia says a word, and suffocating pain crashes in on my lungs. I can't breathe. I open my mouth, and the agony only intensifies. Better it's over fast, I tell myself. But it's not fast enough. The next time I wake, I am alone. I lie there, water flowing around me, lungs clear. Although the bed is still beneath me, I am aware of floating above it. My head hurts, and there is a pain in my stomach that is some combination of hunger and soreness after being punched. The water is cold, a deep chill that seeps into my veins, making my blood sluggish. I'm not sure how long I've been unconscious, not sure how long it's been since I was taken from the tower. As time slips by, and fish come to pluck at my feet and hair, at the stitches around my wound, anger drains away, and despair fills me. Despair and regrets. I wish I'd kissed Terran's cheek before I left. I wish I'd made sure Vivi understood that if she loved a mortal, she had to be more careful with her. I wish I'd told Matic that I always intended for Oak to have the throne. I wish I'd planned more plans. I wish I'd left more instructions. I wish I had never trusted the ghost. I hope Cardin misses me. I'm not sure how long I float like that, how many times I panic and pull against my chains, how many times the weight of the water over me feels oppressive and I choke on it. A merman swims into the room. He moves through the water with immense grace. His hair is a kind of striped green, and the same stripes continue down his body. His large eyes flash in the indifferent light. He moves his hands and makes a few sounds I don't understand. Then, obviously adjusting his expectations, he speaks again.
I am here to prepare you to join Queen Orla for dinner. If you give me any trouble, I can equally, easily, render you unconscious. That's how I'd hoped to find you.
I nod. No trouble. Got it. More merfolk come into the room. Ones with green tails, and yellow tails, and black-tipped tails. They swim around me, staring with their large, shining eyes. One unshackles me from the bed, and another guides my body upright. I have almost no weight in the water. My body goes where it is pushed. When they begin undressing me, I panic again. A kind of animal response. I twist in their arms, but they hold me firm and pull a diaphanous gown over my head. It is both short and thin, barely a garment at all. It flows around me, and I am sure most of my body is visible through it. I try not to look down, for fear that I will blush. Then I am wrapped in ropes of pearls, my hair pulled back with a crown of shells and a net of kelp. The wound on my leg is dressed with a bandage of seagrass. Finally, I am guided through the vast coral palace, its dim light punctuated by glowing jellyfish. The merfolk lead me into a banquet room without a ceiling, so that when I look up, I see schools of fish, and even a shark above me. And above that, the glimmering light of what must be the surface. I guess it's daytime. Queen Orla sits on an enormous throne-like chair at one end of the table, the body of it encased with barnacles and shells, crabs and live starfish crawling over it, fan-like coral and bright anemones moving in the current. She herself is impossibly regal,
Her black eyes rake over me, and I flinch, knowing that I am looking at someone who has ruled longer than the span of generations of mortal lives. Beside her sits Nikasia, in an only slightly less impressive chair, and at the other end of the table is Baelkin, in a chair much diminished from either of theirs.
Jude Duarte, he says, now you know how it feels to be a prisoner. How is it to rot in a cell? To think you will die there?
I don't know, I tell him. I always knew I was getting out. At that, Queen Orla tips back her head and laughs.
I suppose you have, in a manner of speaking, come to me.
I hear the glamour in her voice, and remember what Nikasia said about my not remembering whatever she did to me. Truly, I should be glad she didn't do worse. My flimsy gown makes it clear I am not wearing any charms. They do not know the gesh Dane put on me. They believe I am entirely susceptible to glamours. I can pretend. I can do this. I swim over, keeping my face carefully blank. Orla gazes deeply into my eyes, and it's excruciatingly hard not to look away. To keep my face open and sincere. We are your friends, Orla says, stroking my cheek with long nails. You love us very much, but you must never tell anyone how much outside this room. You are loyal to us, and would do absolutely anything for us. Isn't that right, Jude Duarte?
Yes, I say readily.
What would you do for me, little minnow? She asks.
Anything, my queen, I tell her.
She looks down the table at Baelkin. You see, that's how it's done. He appears sullen. He thinks a lot of himself and mislikes being put in his place. The eldest of Eldred's children. He resented his father for not seriously considering him for the throne. I am sure he hates the way Orla talks to him. If he didn't need this alliance, and if he weren't in her domain, I doubt he would allow it. Perhaps here is a divide for me to exploit. Soon a parade of dishes is brought out in cloches full of air, so that even under the water, they are dry until about to be eaten. Raw fish, cut into artful rosettes and cunning shapes. Oysters, perfumed with roasted kelp. Roe, glistening red and black. I don't know if I may eat without being explicitly granted permission, but I am hungry and willing to risk being reprimanded. The raw fish is mild and mixed in some peppery green. I didn't anticipate liking it, but I do. I quickly swallow 3 pink strips of tuna. My head still hurts, but my stomach starts to feel better. As I eat, I think about what I must do. Listen carefully and act in every way as though I trust them, as though I am loyal to them. To do that, I must imagine myself into at least the shadow of that feeling. I look over at Orla, and imagine that it was she, instead of Matic, who brought me up, that I was Nikasia's sort of sister, who was sometimes mean, but ultimately looked out for me. At Baelkin, my imaginings balk, but I try to think of him as a new member of the family, someone I was coming to trust, because everyone else did. I turn a smile on them. A generous smile. That almost doesn't feel like a lie. Orla looks over at me.
Tell me about yourself, little minnow.
The smile almost wavers, but I concentrate on my full stomach. On the wonder and beauty of the landscape. There's little to know, I say. I'm a mortal girl who was raised in Faerie. That's the most interesting thing about me. Nikasia frowns.
Did you kiss Cardin?
Is that important?
Baelkin wants to know. He is eating oysters, spearing them one after the other with a tiny fork. Orla doesn't answer, just nods toward Nikasia. I like that she does that, putting her daughter above Baelkin. It's good to have something to like about her. Something to concentrate on to keep the warmth in my voice real.
It's important. If it's the reason he didn't agree to an alliance with the Undersea, Nikasia says.
I don't know if I am supposed to answer, I say, looking around in what I hope appears like honest confusion. But yes. Nikasia's expression crumples. Now that I am glamored, she doesn't seem to think of me as a person in front of whom she has to pretend stoicism.
More than once? Does he love you?
I didn't realize how much she'd hoped I was lying when I told her I kissed him. More than once. But no, he doesn't love me. Nothing like it. Nikasia looks at her mother, inclining her head, indicating she got the answers she wanted.
Your father must be very angry with you for ruining all his plans, Orla says, turning the conversation to other things.
He is, I say, short and sweet. No lies I don't have to tell.
Why didn't the general tell Baelkin about Oak's parentage? She continues. Wouldn't that have been easier than scouring Elfheim for Prince Cardin after taking the crown?
I am not in his confidence, I say. Not then, and definitely not now. All I know is that he had a reason.
Doubtless,
Baelkin says.
He meant to betray me.
If Oak was High King, then it would really be Madoc who ruled Elfheim, I say, because it's nothing that they don't know.
And you didn't want that.
A servant comes in with a little silken handkerchief filled with fish. Orla spears one with a long fingernail, causing a thin ribbon of blood to snake toward me in the water.
Interesting.
Since it's not a question, I don't have to answer. A few other servants begin to clear the plates.
And would you take us to Oak's door?
Baelkin asks.
Take us to the mortal world, and take him from your big sister. Carry him back to us?
Of course, I lie. Baelkin shoots a look toward Orla. If they took Oak, they could foster him under the sea. They could marry him to Nikasia. They could have a Greenbriar line of their own, loyal to the Undersea. They would have options beyond Baelkin for access to the throne, which cannot please him. A long game, but in Faerie, that's a reasonable way to play.
This Grimson creature, Orla asks her daughter. You really believe he can make a new crown?
My heart feels for a moment as though it stuttered to a stop. I'm glad no one was looking at me, because in that moment, I do not believe I could have hidden my horror.
He made the blood crown,
says Baelkin.
If he made that, surely he can make another.
If they don't need the blood crown, then they don't need Oak. They don't need to foster him. Don't need him to place the crown on Baelkin's head. Don't need him alive at all. Orla gives him a look that's a reprimand. She waits for Nikasia's answer.
He's a smith, Nikasia says. He cannot forge beneath the sea, so he will always favor the land. But with the death of the Alder King, he craves glory. He wishes to have a High King who will give him that.
This is their plan, I tell myself, to try to stifle the panic I feel. I know their plan. If I can escape, then I can stop it. A knife in Grimson's back before he finishes the crown. I sometimes doubt my effectiveness as a seneschal, but never as a killer.
Little Minnow, Orla says, her attention returning to me. Tell me what Cardin promised you to help him.
But she, Nikasia begins.
But Orla's look silences her.
Daughter, says the Queen of the Undersea, you do not see what is right beneath your nose. Cardin got a throne from this girl. Stop searching for what she has over him, and start looking for what he had over her.
Nikasia turns a petulant look on me.
What do you mean?
You've said that Cardin didn't much care for her.
and yet she made him High King. Consider that perhaps he realized she'd be useful and exploited that usefulness through kisses and flattery, much as you've cultivated the little smith.
Nikasia looks puzzled, as though all her ideas of the world are upset. Perhaps she didn't think of Cardin as someone capable of scheming. Still, I can see something about this pleases her. If Cardin has seduced me to his side, then she need no longer worry that he cares for me. Instead, she need only worry over my usefulness.
What did he promise you for getting him the crown of Elfheim?
Orla asks me with exquisite gentleness. I always wanted a place in Faerie. He told me he would make me his seneschal, and put me at his right hand, like Valmorin in Eldred's court. He'd make sure I was respected, and even feared. It's a lie, of course. He never promised me anything. And Dane promised far less than that. But oh, if someone had, if Matic had, it would have been very hard to turn down.
You're telling me that you betrayed your father and put that fool on the throne in exchange for a job?
Bilkin demands incredulously. Being the High King of Elfheim is also a job, I return. And look at what has been sacrificed to get that. For a moment, I pause, wondering if I have spoken too harshly for them to believe I am still glamored. But Orla only smiles.
True, my dear, she says after a pause. And aren't we putting our faith in Grimson, even as we offer him a not particularly dissimilar reward?
Bilkin looks unhappy, but he doesn't dispute it. Far easier to believe that Cardin was the mastermind than a mortal girl. I manage to eat 3 more slices of fish and drink some kind of toasted rice and seaweed tea through a clever straw that leaves it unmixed with seawater before I am led to a sea cave. Nikasia accompanies the merfolk guards, taking me there. This is no bedchamber, but a cage. Once I am pushed through, however, I discover that while I am still soaking wet, my surroundings are dry and filled with air I abruptly can't breathe. I choke, my body spasming, and up from my lungs comes all that water, along with a few pieces of partially digested fish. Nikasia laughs. Then, glamour heavy in her voice, she speaks.
Isn't this a beautiful room?
What I see is only a rough stone floor. No furniture. No nothing. Her voice is dreamy.
You'll love the 4-poster bed, wrapped in coverlets, and the cunning little side tables, and your own pot of tea. Still steaming. It will be perfectly warm and delicious whenever you try it.
She sets down a glass of seawater on the floor. I guess that's the tea. If I drink it, as she suggests, my body will become quickly dehydrated. Mortals can go for a few days without fresh water. But since I was breathing seawater, I may already be in trouble.
You know,
she says, as I pretend to admire the room, turning around in it in awe, feeling foolish.
Nothing I could do to you will be as terrible as what you'll do to yourself.
I turn to her, frowning in the pretense of puzzlement.
No matter,
she says, and leaves me to spend the rest of the evening tossing and turning on the hard floor, trying to seem as though I feel it is the height of comfort. Chapter 23. I wake to terrible cramps and dizziness. Cold sweat beads on my brow, and my limbs shiver uncontrollably. For the better part of a year, I have been poisoning my body every day. My blood is used to the doses, far higher than they were when I began. Addicted to them. Now, I can't do without the poison. I lie on the stone floor and try to marshal my thoughts.
Try to remember the many times Matic was on a campaign, and tell myself that he was uncomfortable on each one. Sometimes he slept stretched out on the ground, head pillowed on a clump of weeds, and his own arms. Sometimes he was wounded and fought on anyway. He didn't die. I am not going to die, either. I keep telling myself that, but I am not sure I believe it. For days, no one comes. I give up and drink the seawater. Sometimes I think about Cardin while I am lying there. I think about what it must have been like to grow up as an honored member of the royal family. Powerful and unloved. Fed on cat milk and neglect. To be arbitrarily beaten by the brother you most resembled and who most seemed to care for you. Imagine all those courtiers bowing to you, allowing you to hiss and slap at them. But no matter how many of them you humiliated or hurt, you would always know someone had found them worthy of love when no one had ever found you worthy. Despite growing up among the folk, I do not always understand the way they think or feel. They are more like mortals than they believe. But the moment I allow myself to forget they're not human, they will do something to remind me. For that reason alone, I would be stupid to think I knew Cardin's heart from his story. But I wonder at it. I wonder what would have happened if I'd admitted he wasn't out of my system. They come for me eventually. They allow me a little water, a little food. By then, I am too weak to worry about pretending to be glamored. I tell them the details I remember about Maddox's strategy room, and what he thinks about Orla's intentions. I go over the murder of my parents in visceral detail. I describe a birthday, pledge my loyalty, explain how I lost my finger, and how I lied about it. I even lie to them, at their command. And then I have to pretend to forget when they tell me to forget. I have to pretend to feel full when they have told me I feasted, and to be drunk on imaginary wine when all I've had is a goblet of water. I have to allow them to slap me. I can't cry. Sometimes, when lying on the cold stone floor, I wonder if there's a limit to what I will let them do. If there is something that would make me fight back, even if it dooms me. If there is, that makes me a fool. But maybe if there isn't, that makes me a monster.
Mortal girl,
Bilkin says one afternoon, when we're alone in the watery chambers of the palace. He does not like using my name, perhaps because he doesn't like having to recall it. Finding me as disposable as all the human girls who have come through Hollow Hall. I am weak with dehydration. They regularly forget to give me fresh water and food, enchanting me illusory sustenance when I beg for it. I am having difficulty concentrating on anything. Despite the fact that Bailkin and I are alone in a coral chamber, with guards swimming patrols at intervals that I count automatically, I do not even try to fight and flee. I have no weapon, and little strength. Even were I able to kill Bailkin, I am not a strong enough swimmer to make it to the surface before they caught me. My plan has narrowed to endurance, to surviving hour by hour, sunless day by day. Perhaps I cannot be glamored, but that doesn't mean I cannot be broken. Nikasia has said that her mother has many palaces in the undersea, and that this, built into the rock of Innsweel and along the seafloor beneath it, is only one of them. But for me, it is a constant torment to be so close to home, and yet leagues beneath it. Cages hang in the water all through the palace, some of them empty, but many of them containing mortals with graying skin. Mortals who seem as though they ought to be dead, but occasionally move in ways that suggest they are not. The drowned ones, the guards sometimes call them, and more than anything, that's what I fear becoming. I remember thinking I'd spotted the girl I pulled out of Baelkin's house at Dane's coronation. The girl who threw herself into the sea. The girl who'd certainly drowned. Now I am not so sure I was wrong.
Tell me,
Baelkin says today,
why did my brother steal my crown? Orla thinks she understands, because she understands the craving for power. But she doesn't understand Cardan. He never much cared for hard work. He liked charming people. He liked making trouble. But he despaired of real effort. And whether or not Nikasia would admit it, she doesn't understand either. The Cardan she knows might have manipulated you, but not into this.
This is a test, I think nonsensically. A test where I have to lie. But I am afraid my ability to make sense has deserted me. I am no oracle, I say, thinking of Valmorin and the refuge he's found in riddles.
Then guess,
he says.
When you paraded in front of my cell in the Tower of Forgetting, you suggested it was because I'd had a firm hand with him. But you, of all people, must believe he lacked discipline, and that I sought his improvement.
He must be remembering the tournament that Cardan and I fought, and the way he tormented me. I am tangled up in memories, in lies. I am too exhausted to make up stories. In the time I knew him, he drunkenly rode a horse through a lesson from a well-respected lecturer, tried to feed me to Nixies, and attacked someone at a revel, I say. He did not seem to be disciplined. He seemed to have his way all the time. Baelkin seems surprised.
He sought Eldred's attention,
he says finally.
For good or for ill. And mostly for ill.
Then perhaps he wants to be High King for Eldred's sake, I say. Or to spite his memory. That seems to draw Baelkin's attention. Though I said it only to suggest something that would misdirect him from thinking too much about Cardan's motives. Once it comes out of my mouth, I ponder whether there isn't some truth to it. Or because he was angry with you for chopping off Eldred's head. Or being responsible for the deaths of all his siblings. Or because he was afraid you might murder him, too. Baelkin flinches.
Be quiet,
he says. And I go gratefully silent. After a moment, he looks down at me.
Tell me which of us is worthy of being High King. Myself. Or Prince Cardan.
You are, I say easily, giving him a look of practiced adoration. I do not point out that Cardan is no longer a prince.
And would you tell him that yourself?
He asks. I would tell him, whatever you wish, I say, with all the sincerity I can warily muster.
Would you go to him in his rooms, and stab him again and again, until his red blood ran out?
Baelkin asks, leaning closer. He says the word softly, as though to a lover. I cannot control the shudder that runs through me. And I hope he will believe it is something other than disgust. For you? I ask, shutting my eyes against his closeness. For Orla? It would be my pleasure. He laughs.
Such savagery.
I nod, trying to rein in over-eagerness at the thought of being sent on a mission away from the sea, at having the opportunity for escape. Orla has given me so much, treated me like a daughter. I want to repay her, despite the loveliness of my chambers and the delicacies I am given. I was not made to be idle.
A pretty speech. Look at me, Jude.
I open my eyes and gaze up at him. Black hair floats around his face. And here, under the water, the thorns on his knuckles and running up his arms are visible, like the spiky fins of a fish.
Kiss me,
he says. What? My surprise is genuine.
Don't you want to?
He asks. This is nothing, I tell myself. Certainly better than being slapped. I thought you were Orla's lover, I tell him. Or Nikasia's. Won't they mind?
Not in the least,
he tells me, watching carefully. Any hesitation on my part will seem suspicious, so I move toward him in the water, pressing my lips against his. The water is cold, but his kiss is colder. After what I hope is a sufficient interval, I pull back. He wipes his mouth with the back of his hand, clearly disgusted. But when he stares down at me, there's greed in his eyes.
Now kiss me as though I were Cardin.
To buy myself a moment of reflection, I gaze into his owl eyes, run my hands up his thorned arms. It is clearly a test. He wants to know how much control he has over me. But I think he wants to know something else, too. Something about his brother. I force myself to lean forward again. They have the same black hair, the same cheekbones. All I have to do is pretend. The next day, they bring me a pitcher of clear river water, which I guzzle gratefully. The day after that, they begin to prepare me to return to the surface. The High King has made a bargain to get me back. I think over the many commands I gave him, but none was specific enough to have ordered his paying a ransom for my safe return. He had been free of me, and now he is willingly bringing me back. I do not know what that means. Perhaps politics demanded it. Perhaps he really, really didn't like going to meetings. All I know is that I am giddy with relief, wild with terror that this is some kind of a game. If we do not go to the surface, I fear I will not be able to hide the pain of disappointment. Bilkin glamours me again, making me repeat my loyalty to them, my love, my murderous intent toward Cardin. Bilkin comes to the cave where I am pacing back and forth, each scuff of my bare feet on the stone loud in my ears. I have never been so much alone, and I have never had to play a role for this long. I feel hollowed out, diminished.
When we return to Elfheim, we won't be able to see each other often,
he says, as though this is something I will greatly miss. I am so jumpy that I do not trust myself to speak.
You will come to Hollow Hall when you can.
I wonder at the idea that he anticipates living in Hollow Hall, that he doesn't expect to be put in the tower. I suppose his freedom is part of the price of my release, and I am surprised all over again that Cardin agreed to pay it. I nod.
If I need you, I will give you a signal. A red cloth dropped in your path. When you see it, you must come immediately. I expect that you will be able to fabricate some excuse.
I will, I say, my voice coming out too loud in my ears.
You must regain the High King's trust. Get him alone, and then find a way to kill him. Do not attempt it if people are around. You must be clever, even if it takes more than one meeting. And perhaps you can find out more of your father's schemes. Once Cardin is dead, we will need to move fast to secure the military.
Yes, I say. I take a breath, and then dare to ask what I really want to know. Do you have the crown? He frowns.
Very nearly.
For a long moment, I do not speak. I let the silence linger. Into it, Bilkin speaks.
Grimson needs you to finish your work before he can make it. He needs my brother dead.
Ah, I say, my mind racing. Once, Bilkin risked himself to save Cardin. But now that Cardin stands between him and the crown, he seems willing enough to sacrifice his brother. I try to make sense of that, but I can't focus. My thoughts keep spiraling away. Bilkin smiles a shark's grin.
Is something the matter?
I am almost broken. I feel a little faint, I say. I don't know what could be wrong. I remember eating, At least, I think I remember eating.
He gives me a concerned look and calls for a servant. In a few moments, I am brought a platter of raw fish, oysters, and inky roe. He watches in disgust as I devour it.
You will avoid all charms, do you understand? No rowan, no bundles of oak, ash, and thorn. You will not wear them. You will not so much as touch them. If you are given one, you will cast it into a fire as soon as you can conceal doing so.
I understand, I say. The servant has brought no more fresh water for me, but wine instead. I drink it greedily with no care for the strange aftertaste, or how it goes to my head. Balekin gives me more commands, and I try to listen, but by the time he leaves, I am dizzy from the wine, exhausted, and sick. I curl up on the cold floor of my cell, and for a moment, right before I close my eyes, I can almost believe I am in the grand room they have been conjuring for me with their glamours. Tonight, the stone feels like a feather bed.
Chapter 24. The next day, my head pounds as I am once again dressed, and my hair is braided. Merfolk put me in my own clothes, the silver dress I wore to Taryn's wedding, now faded from exposure to salt and frayed from being picked at by undersea creatures. They even strapped Nightfell onto me, although the scabbard is rusted, and the leather looks as though something has been feasting on it. Then I am taken to Balekin, dressed in the colors and wearing the sigil of the undersea. He looks me over and hangs new pearls in my ears. Queen Orla has assembled a huge procession of sea folk. Merfolk, riders on enormous turtles and sharks, the selkies in their seal form, all cutting through the water. The folk on the turtles carry long red banners that fan behind them. I am seated on a turtle, beside a mermaid with two bandoliers of knives. She grips me firmly, and I do not struggle, though it is hard to keep still. Fear is terrible, but the combination of hope and fear is worse. I careen between the two, my heart beating so fast and my breaths coming so quickly that my insides feel bruised. When we begin to rise, up and up and up, a sense of unreality grips me. We crest the surface in the narrow stretch between Innsweil and Innsmire. On the shore of the island, Cardan sits in a fur-lined cloak, regal on a dappled gray steed. He is surrounded by knights in armor of gold and green. To one side of him is Matic, on a sturdy roan. To the other is Nior. The trees are full of archers. The hammered gold of the oak leaves on Cardan's crown seems to glow in the dimming light of sunset. I am shaking. I feel I may shake apart. Orla speaks from her place at the center of our procession.
King of Elfheim, as we agreed, now that you have paid my price, I've secured the safe return of your seneschal. And I bring her to you escorted by the new ambassador of the Undersea, Balekin of the Greenbriar line, son of Eldred, your brother. We hope this choice will please you, since he knows so many customs of the land.
Cardan's face is impossible to read. He doesn't look at his brother. Instead, his gaze goes to me. Everything in his demeanor is icy. I am small, diminished, powerless. I look down, because if I don't, I am going to behave stupidly. You have paid my price, Orla said to him. What might he have done for my return? I tried to recall my commands, to recall whether I forced his hand.
You promised her whole and hale, says Cardan.
And you can see she is so, Orla says. My daughter Nikasia, princess of the Undersea, will help her to the land
with her own royal hands.
Help her?
Says Cardin.
She ought to need no help. You have kept her in the damp and the cold for too long.
Perhaps you no longer want her, Orla says. Perhaps you would bargain for something else in her place, King of Elfheim.
I will have her,
he says, sounding both possessive and contemptuous at once.
And my brother will be your ambassador. It shall all be as we agreed.
He nods toward two knights, who wade out to where I am sitting and help me down. Help me to walk. I am ashamed of my unsteady legs, of my weakness, of the ridiculousness of still being dressed in Oriana's utterly unsuitable dress for a party long over.
We are not yet at war, says Orla. Nor are we yet at peace. Consider well your next move, King of the Land, now that you know the cost of defiance.
The knights guide me onto the land, and past the other folk. Neither Cardin nor Matic turn as I pass them. A carriage is waiting a little ways into the trees, and I am loaded inside. One knight removes her helm. I have seen her before, but I do not know her. The general has instructed me to take you to his home, she says. No, I say. I have to go to the palace. She does not contradict me, nor does she relent. I must do as he says. And although I know I ought to fight, that once upon a time I would have, I don't. I let her shut the door of the carriage. I lean back against the seats and close my eyes. When I wake, the horses are kicking up dust in front of Maddox's stronghold. The knight opens the door, and Narbonne lifts me bodily from the carriage, as easily as I might have lifted oak, as though I am made of twigs and leaves instead of earthly flesh. He carries me to my old bedroom. Tatterfell is waiting for us. She takes down my hair and strips off my dress, carrying away Nightfell and putting me into a shift. Another servant sets down a tray holding a pot of hot tea and a plate of venison, bleeding onto toast. I sit on the rug and eat it, using the buttered bread to sop up the meat juices. I fall asleep there, too. When I wake, Taryn is shaking me. I blink hazily and stumble to my feet. I'm up, I say. How long was I lying there? She shakes her head.
Tatterfell says that you've been out for the whole day and night. She worried that you had a human illness. That's why she sent for me.
Come on, at least get in bed. You're married now, I say, recalling it suddenly. With that comes the memory of Locke and the riders. The earrings I was supposed to give her. It all feels so far away. So distant. She nods, putting her wrist to my forehead.
And you look like a wraith, but I don't think you have a fever.
I'm fine, I say, the lie coming automatically to my lips. I have to get to Cardin and warn him about the ghost. I have to see the Court of Shadows.
Don't act so proud, she says, and there are tears in her eyes. You disappeared on my wedding night, and I didn't even know you were gone until morning. I've been so frightened. When the Undersea sent word it had you, well, the High King and Matic blamed each other. I wasn't sure what was going to happen. Every morning, I went to the edge of the water and looked down, hoping I could see you. I asked all the mermaids if they could tell me if you were okay, but no one would.
I tried to imagine the panic she must have felt, but I can't. They seem to have worked through their differences, I say, thinking of them together at the beach.
Something like it.
She makes a face, and I try to smile. Taryn helps me into my bed, arranging the cushions behind me. I feel bruised all over, sore and ancient, and more mortal than ever before. Vivi and Oak, I ask. Are they okay? Fine, she says.
Back home with Heather, who seems to have gotten through her visit to Fairyland without much drama.
She was glamored, I say. For a moment, I see anger cross her face. Raw and rare. Vivi shouldn't do that, Taryn says. I'm relieved not to be the only one to feel that way. How long have I been gone?
A little over a month, she says.
Which seems impossibly brief. I feel as though I have aged 100 years beneath the sea. Not only that, but now I am more than halfway through the year and a day Cardin promised. I sink back on the cushions and close my eyes. Help me get up, I say. She shakes her head.
Let the kitchen send up more soup.
It isn't difficult to persuade me. As a concession, Taryn helps me dress in clothes that were once too tight and now hang on me. She stays to feed me spoonfuls of broth. When she's ready to go, she pulls up her skirts and takes a long hunting knife out of the sheath attached to a garter. In that moment, it's clear we grew up in the same house. She puts the knife onto the coverlets beside a charm she takes from her pocket.
Here, she says. Take them. I know they'll make you feel safer, but you must rest. Tell me you won't do anything rash.
I can barely stand on my own. She gives me a stern look. Nothing rash, I promise her. She embraces me before she goes, and I hang a little too long on her shoulders, drinking in the human smell of sweat and skin. No ocean, no pine needles, or blood, or night-blooming flowers. I doze off with my hand on her knife. I'm not sure when I wake, but it's to the sound of arguing.
Whatsoever the Grand General's orders, I am here to see the High King's Seneschal, and I won't be put off with any more excuses.
It's a woman's voice, one I half recognize. I roll off the bed, heading dizzily out into the hall, where I can look down from the balcony. I spot Dulcamera from the Court of Termites. She looks up at me. There is a fresh cut on her face.
Your pardon,
she calls in a way that makes it clear she means nothing of the sort.
But I must have an audience. In fact, I am here to remind you of your obligations, including that one.
I recall Lord Roybin with his salt-white hair and the promise I made him for supporting Cardin half a year ago. He pledged to the crown and the new High King, but on a specific condition. Someday, I will ask your king for a favor, he said. What did I say in return? I tried to bargain. Something of equal value, and within our power. I guess he sent Dulcamera to call in that favor, though I do not know what use I am to be when I am like this. Is Oriana in her parlor? If not, show Dulcamera to it, and I will speak with her there, I say, gripping the railing so that I don't fall. Maddox's guards look unhappy, but they don't contradict me.
This way,
says one of the servants, and with a last hostile look at me, Dulcamera follows. This leaves me time to make my unsteady way down the stairs.
Your father's orders were that you not go out, one of the guards says,
used to my being a child to be minded, and not the High King Seneschal, with whom one might behave with more formality.
He wanted you to rest.
By which you mean, he didn't order me not to have audiences here, but only because he didn't think of it. The guard doesn't contradict me, only frowns. His concerns, and yours, are noted. I manage to make it to Oriana's parlor without falling over, and if I hold slightly too long to the wooden trim around windows or to the edges of tables, that's not so awful. Bring us some tea, please. As hot as you can make it, I say to a servant, who watches me a little too closely. Steeling myself, I let go of the wall and walk into the parlor, give Dulcamera a nod, and sink into a chair, although she has remained standing, hands clasped behind her back.
Now we see what your High King's loyalty looks like,
she says, taking a step toward me, her face hostile enough that I wonder if her purpose is more than speaking. instinct wants to push me to my feet. What happened? At that, she laughs.
You know very well,